Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. This is our last podcast of the year. We're a few shopping days from Christmas. And Harriet Russell, how are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, thanks.
You're going to talk to us about shopping.
I am, yes.
Excellent. And we're also joined today by Cully Samra from Charles Schwab. How
Hello.
Are you, Cully?
Good, excited about Christmas. So, good. Absolutely.
We haven't had time to be excited about the Investors Chronicle.
It's from tomorrow
onwards. We've only just noticed.
Yeah, indeed, good. But this is your second time on the podcast.
Yeah, great to be back.
Absolutely, welcome back. We've obviously got some big news to talk about over from the
just
the US
a little bit
today.
just a little bit.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. Graham Davis over in the control room, how are you, Graham?
Hi John, I'm okay. I'm a bit overwhelmed by the thought of Christmas at the moment, but I'm hoping after this weekend it'll be a bit better.
It's a bit overwhelming when you've done no shopping and you know all your attention has been focused on trying to get this magazine ready for the end of the year.
Indeed.
Okay. So I said this was going to be our party podcast. Well, I forgot to bring any booze.
Oh, that's what the listeners think. This table is laden with vodka and whiskey.
Yeah, if only.
You got the party poppers as well.
Yeah. Sorry. My bad. Okay, Graham, let's start with the general market news before we move on to the Fed.
Yeah.
What's been going on?
The back end of last week and the start of this week was pretty grim for equities. I think on Monday, the market fell quite sharply. To a three-year low, for the FTSE 100.
That was the South African thing, wasn't it?
Well, that didn't help. It didn't help. There was a bit of political political madness over there, to be honest, rather than uncertainty.
They've had three
finance ministers
in a week.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So that hit some of the big South African stock, Investec, Old Mutual, took a bit of a beating.
Indeed, yes. And obviously the whole commodity route was ongoing and is still ongoing, and that really hammered things. Tuesday and Wednesday, things calmed down quite a bit in the sort of people were looking ahead to the Wednesday evening UK time announcement from the Fed, and that sort of set the markets back on an even keel. So maybe the Santa rally is finally here.
Yeah, well, as I wrote my editorial last week, Grinch alert, because it did look at that point like Christmas and the Santa rally had been stolen from us. But the effect, according to watchers of these kind of seasonal effects, really starts mid-December anyway. So it kind of arrived on cue.
Well, yeah, and if you look at the last 6 years, the S&P 500 has rallied 3.7% over November and December. So it can be a little bit later, or it can be sort of spread out, but it seems now, I mean, this week in particular we're looking at has been the best week since November 20th, although the last week was pretty dire.
Mm.
Maybe Janet Yellen has been the fairy godmother of the Santa Claus rally, hopefully.
Yeah, which I guess you wouldn't have expected. But there you go.
Yeah.
We'll come on to that in a minute.
Yeah, of course.
We'll come on to that in a minute. My favourite headline in the 7 days page this week, which we debated long and hard, jocks strapped. We're going to get in trouble for this.
We are. But I did run this by our deputy production editor, who is Scottish, and he said he wasn't offended by it.
Yeah, but he's not offended by anything.
No, it's difficult.
He makes a point of offending as many people as he can possibly offend.
It's difficult to offend him. But yeah, no, the story was interesting in that the Scottish government appears to be building up a pretty frightening deficit. Which could be as much as 50 billion by the end of the decade.
So probably lucky they didn't get their way with independence after all.
That is what a lot of unionists would say, yes.
Absolutely. Okay, what else have we got in 7 days? Watchstone, a.k.a. Quindell.
Still
rumbles on.
Yeah, and there's a class action now. 340-odd investors have joined together under the lawyers, Your Legal Friend, and are claiming $9.5 million for losses in their shareholdings when the whole Rob Terry share sale scandal and the accounting scandal blew up at what was Quindell, now Watchstone. Your Legal Friend have said they've got as many as 1,000 people have contacted them about it. So this may not be the end of this.
No. This started a while back, and I wrote an editorial on it at the time because I don't like the idea of being able to reclaim, you know, stock market losses through the courts. I really don't like the idea. I mean, we all know the risks of investing, and yes, we know that sometimes, you know, there was something not quite right about this. There was a bit of dishonesty, but you know, go down this route, a Pandora's box is opened, and you know, every time you lose some money on the stock market,
you go to the courts,
and you know. The business of investing is about managing risk, and that is one of the risks. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of this kind of thing.
Cully's here. Do you see this sort of thing in America, Cully? Because I'm obviously a more litigious culture.
You
I was going to say, there's enough reasons for litigation in the States already.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody going to the courts because of losses in the stock market. That, you know, you can't bat away easily. But yeah, I just hope we don't go down that road. To coin your term, Pandora's box, I think is describing it lightly, really. I mean, big, big problem, especially firms like ours. I mean, we're a very large broker with lots of clients, and they're likely to come after us, I guess. Who else are they going to go after?
I mean, I guess they go after management.
After the company's management.
Or the nomads, or anyone that they can attribute responsibility for the misinformation that they base their investment decisions on.
Yeah, and that may be based, maybe put at the doors of the brokers. You know, obviously we are one of the firms that provide research to our clients, but they might come after us for giving recommendations.
Yeah, it's not a good thing,
no,
necessarily. Okay, VW is still suffering. We've all seen some shocking figures there in terms of car sales in the past month since the scandal broke.
It looks like there has been an effect. You know, no matter what the management there say, there has been a reputational hit.
Yeah.
And that's been reflected on the forecourts.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear indeed.
Okay, so the Fed has awoken, I read today, to keep the Star Wars puns flowing, because this week is the launch of Star Wars The Force Awakens, which has got me very excited indeed.
I'm quite excited as well.
Everyone's excited.
Of course we are.
Apart from people who read Comet is Free on The Guardian.
I have to say I'm probably moderately excited.
Really, my wife's excited and she doesn't normally watch Star Wars, so.
I'm much more of a Trekkie, put it that way.
Okay.
Oh. My kids are Trekkies. They like the old Star Treks. But I'm very excited. I sat in the cinema to watch The Hunger Games Part 4.
Oh,
and the Star Wars trailer came on.
Your own,
and
that was,
no, my family.
I know, I'm kidding.
Star Wars trailer came on and I've got to say there was some emotion welling up there. It was just bizarre.
Yeah,
I didn't think it's a what?
I think it's our age. I think it's our age demographic. We're harping back to simpler days.
I think that might be it.
Yeah,
but I think
soft in your old age, John.
I've always been a softie. Really. The cinema gets me. I don't know why. And I talked this week in my editorial about Disney, who are the franchise owner of Star Wars. Yeah. And we were going to talk about this after we talked about the Fed. We might as well talk about it now because we brought it up. Yeah, this is going to be huge. And Cully, you mentioned some figures that.
I mean the figures vary. I mean you and I were talking about this before we came on, whether it's going to be a total of $3 billion or $4 billion generated by this one movie
for Disney,
through a combination of box office numbers and also all the merchandise they sell as well. But you know, it looks like a really smart move for them to have bought Disney.
Yeah.
There are all these other smaller movies they're going to be spinning off as well. Obviously, the theme parks will change. They'll have Star Wars elements within the theme parks. They're building multiple theme parks across Asia as well, especially China. I think I read they're doing something like 10 theme parks across China.
Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so there's going to be a lot of theme park growth as well. And, they're very clever in the way they've integrated the Star Wars brand into their Disney stores already. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, they don't hang about.
No, they don't.
Our colleague Algie Hall was mentioning it was his son's birthday recently. Everything he got was Star Wars.
Star Wars, yeah. And I think one of the things Disney have done is change the way that the segments work. So rather than sort of having confines and you're just covering online or just covering, one element, they've tried to make sure it's overarched across the different silos.
Mm.
So they're trying to move away from this silo mentality is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And of course they've got Marvel too, which has been an enormous moneymaker for them.
Again, more spin-offs.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. So when I looked at their numbers, I just kind of started thinking about Star Wars and holding back the tears on the Bloomberg terminal. 8 quarters in a row, it's beaten earnings forecasts.
Fantastic.
And it might even go back further. I couldn't actually work out how to dig that information out, but it's phenomenal.
Well, that's interesting because, there's been a transformation in terms of the US consumer, which we've been talking about over this year. You know, the US consumer has received all this money from a windfall of low oil prices, and everybody's been wondering, what have they been doing with this money? And one of the contentions is they've been spending it more on experiences as opposed to big ticket items. Experiences being going to the movies, going to parks, that kind of thing. So clearly, they're one of the retailers that are benefiting from that shift in the US consumer. And it's a good company. I'm sure they pay a pretty decent dividend as well.
It's not huge.
Okay.
That was the one thing that I found a little bit disappointing. But, it's not non-existent.
Yeah.
But I think people are underestimating what this film could do. Yeah. I think it's huge.
Yeah. Keen to see how it affects stock flights in the world as well. I mean, that's had a fantastic year. It's had Bond, Hunger Games, and now Star Wars. So hopefully it rounds off 2015 for it as a...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Stephen Wilmot, our outgoing companies editor, because he will be gone soon. We will never hear his dulcet tones on this podcast ever again, which is a great shame. But he mentioned to me, we're in a deflationary environment with a lot of goods, but retail experiences are in an inflationary environment still. Yeah. So, you know, cinema operators can continue putting up ticket prices. It's one of the few areas where they have that pricing power.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I used to cover travel and leisure here before Bradley joined us, obviously. And I mean, one of the huge topics I would speak to many, not just Cineworld, people like Restaurant Group as well, did fantastically out of the recession. People put money into experience more than they do into material items. Yeah. And it's, it doesn't seem to be sort of a trend that's going away very quickly now that the economy is sort of showing a bit of growth.
It, you say that, but I mean, Dixon's Car Phone. We completely sidetracked from the Fed. Maybe we'll come back to the Fed in a bit.
Because
we kind of segued into retail.
Yeah, we have.
Now, which, let's carry on. Let's go with the flow.
Okay.
So, Dixon's Car Phone had great results this week. You know, that merger is working out really well.
Yeah, really, really well. Obviously, we're a year or so on from that. And interestingly, I mean, I think there's always a very keen eye on electrical sales as part of retail in general. And it seems to be good for Dixon's, not so good for people like Home Retail Group who, you know, have Argos issues and things like that.
I guess it comes back to the fact that they have these bigger ticket items, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas, and they said, actually, they were talking a little bit on the call about Black Friday and what sort of trends they'd seen coming out of that. And although there were no sort of real hard figures as yet, they're obviously saving that for their January flashy trading update. But they were saying that of the things that were really popular, it was white goods. And those did actually outstrip things like mobiles and tablets on the day. But, you know, in general demand for tablets and mobiles is still strong.
You mentioned Black Friday. That is actually an event in the States for a reason, because it's Thanksgiving the day before.
Well, indeed.
Mm. Exactly. And it was the first time in the States that online spending outstripped actual in-store spending.
Yeah.
So it's the same way as you're seeing over here. You've got winners and losers in the States. You've got those that have bricks and mortar and those that are predominantly online. They're the main winners, really.
Mm. No, I read something interesting that actually it's a carpet right, which has been a perennial underachiever.
Yeah.
You know, I first sold that years ago and it's just down and down and down after that. But they've had some decent figures.
Yeah, really starting to come back, actually. Really, really sort of when I speak to the management guys over there, I'm actually pretty impressed, I have to say. And I mean, I have yet to be a carpet right customer. So.
I have been a carpet right customer twice.
But I used to live pretty near a giant Carpet Right store, and you know, it was really down in the doldrums. A lot looked really, really shabby. And you know, one of the big things that management had put on the top of the to-do list is to really overhaul that store estate, put them in much more affluent areas, and really sort of attract a different clientele. I mean, they don't put it that bluntly, but that is what they're trying to do, and it seems to be working.
Having been in the store recently, I mean, they're still a bit old-fashioned. There is a whiff of late 80s about
them. Definitely.
But nevertheless, the figures are working out well for them at the moment. And what they said, and what I actually heard the management of Dixon's Car Phone talking about, is when you're spending a lot of money on something like a carpet or a telly, you want to go in and see it. So actually the bricks and mortar side of things is important for those still, even though a lot of business is moving online.
And interestingly, Carpet Right is pretty much the only retailer I've spoken to this week who has no interest in talking about the importance of Christmas trading. For them, it's a non-event.
It's a non-event, yeah.
And I think Wilf actually said that they're shutting down from pretty much this weekend. They put loads of the stores on you know, holiday shutdown, basically, let their staff have a real rest, and then they sort of ramp up again in January when everyone's got, you know, new year, new home fever.
Absolutely. Well, I'm doing a bit load of building work at the moment. So
you're a brave man.
Indeed. So I haven't done any Christmas shopping, but in the last week I spent £500 on bathroom fittings. I'm about to blow a grand on flooring, and I am actually buying it all online. Because, you know, there were some smart retailers out there who are doing some good things. And the flooring stuff is amazing. Yeah. They'll send you boxes of samples for free. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, making it easy.
I have spoken to Carpet Right Management, not this week, but we have spoken about it in the past as well, that online for them is a massive research tool. And they really shouldn't underestimate that. They say, you know, customers, you can't necessarily get the sale to convert online in the way that a lot of other retails, it's just natural. But they say their customers come into store, they pretty much already know what they want. They've done their research and it cuts out a huge amount of sort of, you know, sales gump and kind of that awkward in-store, you know, hard sell. So that's,
so did they miss the whole wooden floor trend? Is that part of the reason they're in trouble? And have they now fixed that trend? Or because what are you putting in your floors?
Engineered wood.
There you go.
They don't have any engineered wood.
There you go.
They only have laminate. And we're not buying laminate.
Yeah, no. Most people in this bracket wouldn't, I guess, really. And that's something.
No, it's going to be interesting how they sort of upgrade. I think they've upgraded the store experience to treat this new affluent customer. Quite how the product range really addresses that affluent customer, I'm not sure yet. I think they probably have more to go on that front.
But this is always, you know, I always scratch my head. You know, we're just shooting the breeze here and we've come to a conclusion, which you think most of the listeners would come to as well. Doesn't this come down to research that they need to do amongst their consumers?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, actually, because they're going to actually launch. It was part of the results. they made a really big deal of it, actually, as part of the statement and on the call, which was they're going to do a huge customer survey in January 2016, which basically
which
addresses...
they hadn't done before, right?
They have never done it before, wow. apparently. I mean, Wolf Warshaw has only been there for 18 months, so it's definitely part of his
Good
strategy to really get to know the customer base a lot more and basically just give them what they want. Yeah. I mean, it's really...
It's not hard, right?
Yeah, it's not harder than that.
I mean, it is an old carpet, right? It's an old-fashioned retail. It was, you know, it's been family-owned, still probably majority family-owned at the moment, but it was run by its founder, and then the founder's son was in a senior management position as well, or something, you know.
Yeah, but you see a lot of family-owned companies, right? Walmart is was a family-owned company, and look what it did. And that's about listening to your customers, and it's good to hear that they're doing that finally. Though.
Yeah, they're really going to put their hands up, yeah. I think, good. And take some accountability.
Absolutely. I mean, while we're on the subject of electronics, which we've sort of moved away from a little bit towards carpet, you know, let's talk about Imagination, which had a big profit warning this week in the context of Apple. Mm. So I guess the problem with Imagination is, you know, not enough devices are being shipped that gives it the royalties. Mm. You know, I was listening again to the radio this morning, as I do, the business chat, and, you know, there's a worry that we've hit peak Apple. Tablet sales,
that.
I mean, car phones and tablet sales are not holding up as well as they
On the Dixon's call, Humphrey Singer was saying that, you know, as much as mobile, sort of demand for mobile in the UK was stronger than they expected, they did actually call this sort of a bit of a leap year in terms of iPhone sales, because it was only the launch of an S model. And he seems a lot more optimistic about the launch of a 7. He says that will sort of drive more customers to upgrade. So I'd be interested to see if he's right.
The secret lab that Apple has opened up in Taiwan. Did you hear about that this week?
No.
I did.
No.
How can you call
that
it secret? And I think what Apple are looking at now is making the leap from computer processing to the material that the iPhone's made of. And that'll be where the leaps will happen, whether it's the screens or the actual material itself. You know, one of the things they're going to dispense with the headphone jack...
Right.
Change the charging functionality, so we might be surprised.
I just like a more robust screen, please. Had my 6S Plus for 2 weeks before I smashed that baby.
I'd like a battery that lasts more than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
My battery's not that bad. My iPhone 5 was horrific, but...
Yeah, it's getting better.
Yeah, it's getting better.
This is like a focus group for Apple.
It is. let's stop doing their work for
Your point there, I mean, we had Imagination, which you said, and IQE this week, both trading updates, both said mobile has been weaker.
Yeah,
recently. Yeah. So just interesting, but maybe it is that upgrade cycle. We're in a step year, the S year, rather than the proper. I don't know.
Or just saturation. Or just general saturation.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Well, let's see what happens this Christmas. I guess we'll see whether the iPhone is the hot gift out of 2015, as it has been in previous years. Who knows?
Who knows?
Let's talk supermarkets quickly. Well, you mentioned Walmart. Let's talk British supermarkets.
Yep.
Because you've done those in the sector focus.
I have. Ian and I filmed a short video this morning, if anyone wants to go and check that out on the website. But it's sort of a comprehensive look, really, at sort of what the current trends are, really what the state of the discounters is, and sort of what investors can really expect out of this sector, if anything at all.
It's been a bit of a horror show in recent
years. It's
been
a horror show, it really has. But I've probably spoken to just about all of them, I would say, certainly in the last quarter, but, you know, in the last month or so, actually, string of results from all of them. So we're kind of taking a bit of a sort of eagle-eye view on the whole thing, and we're picking our favourites and our not-so-favourites.
Okay, well, read the magazine, you'll find out who they are.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to give the game away.
Too much away. Okay. But again, Christmas is going to be all important for those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was Mike Coop at Sainsbury's who said that, you know, he's going to hold his hands up and everyone wants to win Christmas, was his turn of phrase. And I think what is interesting, and this is his point, so, you know, forgive the paraphrasing, but he does say that Christmas is an interesting time in the context of the discounters, because obviously all year long they're losing market share to discounters. People tend to trade down. It's borne out the recession, right? And that hasn't ended. But interestingly, at Christmas, it's the one time that people want to feel a bit more special and they start to trade up again. So, you know, things like Taste the Difference at Sainsbury's start to fly off the shelves. People even go as far as Waitrose, M&S Food, they push the boat out.
Mm. Discounters, the product quality, though, is pretty good.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, too. Lidl, this week and last, has been making some noise on two fronts, actually. One, it's going to take its business online, which is going to be massive. And the second is that they're really trying to address this customer that they know is a premium customer through and through, even a Waitrose shopper or something like that, but they're trading down because they want value for money. And what Lidl doesn't want is, well, what they do want is to make that customer feel especially comfortable in their stores. So they're going to be pouring a huge amount of investment into upgrading their store estate, making them really plush, modern, etc., trying to do away with those horrendous checkout lines and things that
Aldi's always, Aldi's always talking about blind testing, aren't they, whenever they blind test their food next to other brands, and people generally quite surprised themselves.
Yeah. So. They win a lot of those, those taste tests.
Yeah. I think if you speak to the general public, it's, the quality of the product is not what gets people down. It's the shopping experience. And I think Lidl has really caught on to that, and they're going to try their best to make it not so. But I mean, what's interesting is having a conversation with Algie earlier today was that he was reading some things about really the margins are on an absolute sort of knife edge at the discounts for obvious reasons. And it's to what extent can they really afford that investment without taking some sort of hit on the margins? Obviously, the middle market being squeezed by the discounters, it won't necessarily have that same challenge. So they've had to be making these adjustments the whole time. Is it the return of the middle market? Is that around the corner?
Who knows? We'll see.
Well, I've never been into an Aldi or a Lidl, but my town is getting both an Aldi and a Lidl in the next year.
I won't give my exact address away, but I do live in Battersea, and we have a Lidl, and it is right next door, and I mean right next door. They share a car park to Asda, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
John, when you covered the retail sector, you used to pride yourself on your scuttlebutt.
Yeah.
And now you haven't been near an Aldi or a Lidl?
They weren't really a phenomenon, but I missed it, all right. Who are you trying to do? Catch me
out. Your age. Your age again.
Yeah, I was aware of them.
Good.
I was aware of them.
Good.
But, you know, I'm middle market through and through.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, listen, we've digressed from what we originally started to talk about. Let's go back to it, the Fed.
Yep.
The Fed has awoken. Cully, what's going on?
Yeah, so it's been a long melodrama to lift or not to lift. And I guess the concern is that it might be a disaster, but we don't think so. We've been calling for a rate lift for a very long time now. Finally, it happened. I mean, today's Thursday and it happened overnight. It's only 25 basis points. They'll go from near zero to 25 to 50 basis points. There are a couple of things in there which were a little bit more hawkish than everybody expected, which is probably why the dollar's slightly stronger today. And one of those, without getting into the detail, is the Fed's dot plots, or the expectations of where rates will be this time next year. The Fed now expects 1.375 in terms of where they'll be in December 2016, which hasn't changed from before this meeting, which surprised everyone. The other thing that was surprising is a unanimous decision. You know, we've had dissenters before. We know that it's quite a dovish Fed composition overall, but there are no dissenters. So it's a good thing. You know, there's a lot of central banks which would be enviable of the Fed's position, being able to lift, because fundamentally the US economy is in a good place. So I'm really, really happy. A lot of my clients are very, very happy. And it's a good thing, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, from a philosophical point of view, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, loose monetary policy has caused a lot of problems over the years.
Potentially, the Fed would argue that actually they've single-handedly pushed unemployment from 10% to 5%. That's what their argument would be. Some people would argue, well, they've actually created all these bubbles which are waiting to pop.
Yes.
So that's obviously the counter-argument you refer to.
Asset price inflation.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not, not in some areas, but in others, certainly stock markets, for example, it's property bubbles forming and such alike, has made life difficult for some people.
Yeah, I think property, especially in the States, the commercial property market is the big concern at the moment. And that seems to be, we've been talking about the next shoe to drop for, I can't remember how many years now, with the commercial property market. The residential property market has picked up, decently. It's not near bubble territory yet. Lending is still very strict when you take a mortgage out. So, and it's sort of very regional as well. I think in the UK we have two regions, right? In London and outside of London. In the States, you have much more regionality, the Washington area, New York area, all these other areas. But it's a net positive, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the great concern, though, is that, whilst the US economy is strong and can obviously cope with a rate rise, perhaps the rest of the world can't. So there will be knock-on effects that that are unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of those potential negative knock-on effects have already fed through. Everybody's concerned about what might happen to emerging markets and the tsunami of cash that might leave emerging markets. Some of that has already happened. And emerging markets, as you and I, as I'm sure your readers know as well, you shouldn't lump into one big block. I'd heard a new term, BARC.
I've not heard that one before.
Brazil, Australia, Russia and Canada.
So Australia is now an emerging market?
Yeah. That's what I thought as well.
There's a few of those. There's Mint, isn't there?
Yeah, there's all kinds.
N11.
Emerging or middle markets or whatever you want to call them. And these are commodity markets generally.
Yeah.
All four of them. And then the Chinese story as well, which, you know, it's moving away from emerging market as well. And again, to that, stealing this from a client, the power of big numbers. When China was growing at 14%, the size of the economy was something like $3.6 trillion. In 2014, when it grew at 7%, the size of the economy was well over $10 trillion. So, you know, all these other concerns that we've got in all the different regions because of the US lifting rates, I think, you know, they might be a little bit overblown. Both the IMF and the OECD expect higher growth next year, global growth.
That said, the US is the only market where we are seeing a tightening of monetary policy, yep. really. Yep. So, you know, Europe is loosening.
Yep.
The UK is not tightening.
Yeah.
Japan is loosening. China is offering up stimulus where it needs to.
Yep.
You know, and you could infer from that that a lot of the other central bankers around the world don't think that the global economy is that strong.
Yeah, I mean, they assume that monetary policy is a cure-all. They think that all the structural problems they have, both in Japan and Europe, especially in the labour market, can be cured with monetary policy because it seemed to have worked in the States.
Mm.
And I think the fundamental difference with the States is the degree of labour market flexibility that you have. I don't know if the Fed is completely right about the labour market. You know, they're still hung up on this Phillips curve idea that if you push inflation, if you push unemployment low enough, there's an inverse relation to inflation. And, you know, some people are saying that's not necessarily true. But going back to what we're saying about, you know, all the other countries loosening monetary policy, you know, that combined with valuations, there's this deep, deep assumption that all these other markets will outperform the US next year. You have to be careful about everybody assuming to be on one side of the trade, which seems to be what's happening at the moment.
So your view would be, I guess, that the US is still going to be a good performer next year?
2.8% GDP growth compared to 1% for Japan, 1.6% I think for Europe, a sideways year this year, a lot of volatility this year in the States. A consumer, you know, we've already talked about the consumer a little bit, in a very good place at the moment. So it could turn out to be a pretty good year for the US next year. And I'm not just talking my own book.
Indeed. I would never accuse you of such a thing.
There's a bias there. but you know, I genuinely think that the Fed is moving rates for a good reason. And that's because of the underlying strength in the economy.
So it's, I mean, the economy's strong.
Yep.
Markets, I mean, how's this going to translate through to the markets? Because, I mean, earnings in the US have not been spectacular.
No. And I know you shouldn't really do this, but if you strip out energy, they haven't been that bad.
Right.
And, you know, asking about markets, the question I've had over and over again from our clients and people in your business as well is, you know, we've had a very long bull market. In fact, we've had a very long business cycle as well. This business cycle is 78 months long. Post-Second World War, average business cycles last 58 months. So I wrote this down, and this is from Sir John Templeton. And bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. So my question to anybody listening to this podcast and to you guys is, do you think we're optimistic or euphoric at the moment? Either of those two.
I'm never optimistic, and I'm certainly not euphoric, apart from when it comes to the Star Wars film.
Yeah, I'd say we're only ever on the cusp of optimism at the moment.
We're on the cusp.
Yeah. And it wouldn't take long for someone to cut you down pretty quickly. So
yeah.
it can only be at the beginning of that curve, surely.
Yeah, and I think everyone's still slightly sceptic as well.
Mm.
And if you look at the amount of money that's flown out of US mutual funds, equity mutual funds, $143 billion came out of US mutual funds last year just for equities. So clearly there's a lot of skepticism in the States about the States still. So we don't think the bull market is dead.
No. I mean, there's a view expressed in the magazine that in terms of valuations, the US is a bit more expensive than a lot of other markets. For a reason. Europe is cheaper. Because the earnings growth hasn't yet come through, but with what's going on behind the scenes in Europe and at European companies, this might be the year for Europe. So
yeah, I mean, I'm not writing off Europe. You know, everybody has to be globally diversified to a degree nowadays. And what our question nowadays is, do you think you have enough US exposure based upon how big the US market actually is in terms of global diversification? And generally, what we find with UK investors is that they are slightly underexposed.
Well, it's a funny, I mean, in terms of how you get that US exposure,
yeah.
you either go down the individual stock picking route,
yeah.
which for the US market is probably easier to access than many others, in fact.
Yeah, it normally is. The thing is, it's been very, very difficult to be a bottom-up investor because stocks have been so correlated with what's been going on with the macro picture.
Yeah.
And so a lot of our clients who were bottom-up have sort of not given up on that, but now sort of looking more at the macro picture, especially with what the Fed has been doing. The Fed has been had its hand in so much of market movements that it's been very difficult to be bottom-up. Maybe now with the Fed trying to normalize, you can get more success being a stock picker. I hope that is the case.
We hope that's the case.
Yeah.
Certainly. So, I mean, it's felt like a bit of a thankless task over the last God knows how many years.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's frustrating. Really frustrating.
Trying to take a value-led approach or, you know, trying to even take a fundamental approach is often at times felt like a fruitless challenge.
Yeah, completely.
So yeah, I would like to see that that change. And we talked very briefly about some of the equities that Theron talks about in our US bumper feature this year. We talked Disney already. I think we're all in agreement. Good story there. Nike you mentioned as well. That jumped out at you.
Yeah, Nike jumped out at me because going back to the China story, we know that China is trying to make this big transition and move away from being a manufacturing economy to be a consumer-driven economy. Q3 earnings season for the States was very interesting because there were the winners and losers from those that do business in China. One of the losers was Caterpillar because they make these big goods which are obviously used for manufacturing. One of the winners was Nike, who I believe had 35% sales growth in China, I think on a year-over-year basis. And this is all about the transition of the, you know, the growth of the consumer in China. And so it's an interesting company. Again, I'd be interested to see what kind of dividend they pay because that could be an interesting look.
Yeah,
certainly
absolutely.
Also sounds like it speaks to power of brand as well from a retail point of view. I mean, if it's capturing imagination, I cover a number of retailers that are struggling like hell in China to capture any kind
because
of consumer.
Because of brand.
Yeah, well, I think it has a lot to do with brand. And it's just interesting that there seems to be this narrative about China's consumer story, but it doesn't seem to apply to all retailers. And when you ask what the difference is, I think very often it must come down to quality and brand.
Well, you've got Mulberry in the magazine as week, and they've had a bit of a nightmare getting out there, and obviously Burberry as well have had a struggle there.
And we've recently put sell advice out on Jimmy Choo for the same reason. So
Prada had a nightmare recently as well, didn't they, this week?
Retail in general, it's really hurting. Struggling in China. Coach actually, which we've looked at in the past, another US equity that's been doing terribly in China recently as well.
Absolutely.
You'd be fascinated once somewhere like China comes out with their own luxury brand or their own version of Nike that actually sells overseas, and some of the tech companies are trying to do it. It'd be interesting to see when they start to move some more to these consumer goods. Are you seeing any of that? Are you hearing any of that?
I mean, there have been a couple of disaster companies on AIM.
Let's not talk about them.
That have really, really tried to sort of do that. But, you know, it has yet to really, I think, match. The problem is, I think, when you try and take on someone like Nike, you're battling legacy as well as quality and brand. I mean, you're battling years and years of established market footholds. So.
Indeed. I mean, that's how I describe Disney in my editorial this week. It's a one-of-a-kind company. You can't replicate that.
No, you just cannot
replicate it.
And, you know, talking about the power of brand, Nike, I think, signed up LeBron. Is it LeBron
James? Yeah.
$500 million
incredible.
For a lifetime contract.
Yeah, lifetime agreement. Yeah.
And poor David Beckham gets $130 million from Adidas.
You should feel very hard done by.
My point exactly.
Okay, actually, one's jumping out at me, Pfizer, because obviously Pfizer is part of the biggest M&A deal of the year, second biggest of all time.
Yep.
So we've got Harriet here, who understands the sector.
Well, yes, healthcare.
And Cully, who's obviously, you must have paid attention to the huge wave of M&A that's taken place.
Obviously, that's driven by the sort of reverse taxation.
Yeah, I mean, I'd written on healthcare M&A all year, really tracking the pattern. And I think one of the points that I keep having to try and reiterate, and, you know, it does feel a bit like Groundhog Day, is that you've got to look at the motivation for these deals. Anyone that watched Pfizer try and make their pump for AstraZeneca last year will know that they've got a huge cash pile currently lodged offshore that they're desperately trying to repay. Repatriate, not having it subject to US taxes. And the easiest way to do that is to take over a foreign company that's got a tax domicile elsewhere, which is exactly what Allergan's got. It's got an Irish domicile. So what they'll effectively do is take it over, but they'll appoint Allergan as the parent, from what I understand, and take over the Irish domicile. So it means that Pfizer can then bring that cash back onshore, and it will be subject to a far lower tax rate. It's also interesting because they're going to get a one-off windfall from it, because so far Pfizer has had to lodge a $21 billion provision against that cash on the off chance that they might have to bring it back into the US. Now that that's not going to happen, they can wipe that provision right off, and their balance sheet suddenly looks a lot healthier.
You know, what has been amazing about all these taxation deals is the vitriol being poured out of the press in the States, because I watch the press obviously very carefully, and companies like these are being questioned for their lack of patriotic commitment, when what they should be doing is questioning the tax code in the States, which is, you know, one of the biggest problems that the States has, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've also said in the coverage of Pfizer and Allergan that we've done is that, you know, it's exactly the reason that the AbbVie and Shire deal fell through, is that the Treasury are hot on this stuff and they want to close the loophole when they can. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Treasury throw everything they've possibly got to stop this going through in terms of competition reviews and all sorts of things. So I was convinced that AbbVie and Shire would go through, and it didn't.
Yeah.
So.
Well, patriotism is something that's very rare on the UK market, it has to be said. But actually, there is a bit of speculation this week, and this actually does involve the government, Rolls-Royce. So Rolls-Royce has been having a very tough time. 5 profit warnings in a row, I think it is. Big management restructuring announced this week by new boss Warren East. But rumours circling, Graham, you must be looking at these, over a potential merger with BAE.
Wow.
Well, there was two strands to this. But one of which was that the government may be looking at nationalising Rolls-Royce's submarines business.
Okay.
Because they don't want, I think the fear is that Rolls-Royce's shares have fallen so far, and now there's an activist on board, that there could be something corporate action going on, and Rolls-Royce could be being eyed up by an overseas buyer.
But it had,
and
there's
they
a golden
want the, that. Yeah,
there's a golden stake.
There's a golden stake from the government, but obviously they don't want any chance of the submarines business falling into foreign hands. The other option is a possible merger with BAE.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Which would be huge.
Absolutely huge.
Huge.
Really
but
big
that,
stuff.
That is protecting national interests as rather than, you know, sticking up for British jobs or anything. It's national interests there.
Which we don't do enough in this country, really, do we?
No.
What, protecting our national interests when it comes to companies, some of the bigger deals that we see?
Yeah.
But
then,
you know, I mean, the only big deal I remember there being any sort of kind of fervent outpouring of nationalistic fervour for was Cadbury.
Cadbury's,
of
yeah.
all things.
But then the deal still went through, though.
Well, it did go through. But, you know, it was an odd thing to get so worked up about, I think. It's a chocolate.
It became
maker,
a bit of a political football, that one.
It did.
Vince Cable was all over it, standing up for the little man sort of thing, you know. And it's all, yeah. But it didn't happen. It didn't work anymore.
Well, look, I mean, the French did it with Danone. And they're a yogurt maker, ostensibly, aren't they? So
yeah, yeah.
We should do it more.
Well, the US have done it several times in the past it's come to, I mean, I think
oil
it was...
Oil companies with Chinese oil companies.
Chinese buyers, usually.
CNOOC try to buy some companies in the States. They cite national interests.
Well, there was another one that I looked at several years ago. I think it was Whirlpool, the goods manufacturer.
Yeah, yeah.
And a Chinese buyer was interested in that, and that was blocked.
Because
of national interest.
Wow.
I've heard the technology in washing machines is very sophisticated these days.
Must be.
Cannot
Must
cross
be.
Borders. Fascinating stuff there. So we'll be keeping our eyes peeled on that one, because it's...
It'll just be interesting to see what happens to the M&A market next year. If we've got, you know, normalising interest rates in the States and going the opposite direction in other countries, it'll be fascinating to see what happens with that.
It would be ridiculous to think it could top this year, which was... I mean, it's the record year.
Well,
it's
over 2007, though, right? I mean...
Well, yeah, was that 4.6 trillion?
Yeah.
And we hit that at the end of November. So, yeah. You know, it's got to be approaching 5, because a big deal was announced since then.
Mm. But American companies are probably, you know, the dollar is worth, you know, the dollar is very strong.
Yeah,
they've
got
a lot of power in that at the moment, and they're looking at assets in Europe and the UK and Asia, and, you know, they've got a lot of spending power.
So potentially a reason to stay invested in some of the more struggling industries, because there may be a bit of consolidation on the way.
Hmm.
Well, interesting stuff. Okay, well, thank you, Cully. Thank you for coming in. That's a really fascinating insight into kind of it's quite a US perspective on what's going on with the Fed, which we don't really hear that much over here.
Right.
So no, thank you.
Pleasure.
Great, and thank you, Harriet.
Yeah,
it worked out rather nicely, hasn't
it? Finish our drinks off now, shall we?
yeah.
And thank you, of course, Graham, over there in the control room.
I'll get back to my eggnog.
Eggnog.
Mm.
Yeah, so as I said, this week was our bumper issue. It was a real effort to put it together. It's 104 pages, not a lot of advertising, which is often the case at this time of year. So a real massive effort from the team to put those features together. There's a few results in there, as we said, mostly from the
retail
consumer sectors. All the usual comments, and we even have some tips at this time of year. A little Christmas presents there for you. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, which they will no doubt discuss on their podcast tomorrow. And Algie Hall has done a roundup of his stock screen for the year, which are flying, as they always do.
And is this the last one for the year, or have you got another one?
No, we've got one more for the year. New Year's Eve edition, look out for that. And that will actually be about the secrets of small cap success. Algie Hall's putting that together as well. He's interviewed some of the best small cap fund managers out there to find out how they go about navigating what can be quite a tricky market. Okay, thank you again, everybody. And thank you all for listening this year. We've had a lot of fun doing it. And we'll be back in the new year. Hopefully we'll continue to make this bigger and better. And I'd just like to wish you all a Merry Christmas before we go. Hope you have a really lovely time. And we'll be back again in 3 weeks, I think. Okay, have a great time. Have a great Christmas. See you soon.